Thanks for hitting that button. You are listening to the Mark the Shark Show.
All right, guys, you ready to rock? Are you excited? Well, sit back and enjoy. And welcome to the Mark the Shark Show. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Mark the Shark Show. Hope everyone's having a great day. We have a great episode in store for you, so sit back and enjoy the show. Hi, everyone. This is your host, Mark the Shark. I want everybody to know that not only do I have this podcast, I have another podcast about the sport of mixed martial arts. So if you're into that kind of thing, check out my other podcast called The Mark the Shark MMA Show. And if you want to be on that show or this show, make sure you contact me on Facebook at Mark the Shark MMA Show. And that's my Facebook channel. Or you can go to my website, www.markthesharkmmashow.com. Again, it's www.markthesharkmmashow.com. And you can also follow me on Instagram at Mark_Ritorto2. That's Mark, M-A-R-C, underscore Ritorto, R-I-T-O-R-T-O, 2. That's for Instagram, or Mark BJJ Fighter on Twitter. And also, don't forget to check out my YouTube channels. I got the Rockin' with Mark YouTube channel. That's Rockin' with Mark with a C again. Or the Mark the Shark MMA Show, all on YouTube. All right, guys. Hope you enjoy the podcast and keep on listening. Hey, guys. The spooky season is just around the corner. What better way to get into the spirit of things than listening to the two witchy hosts of the Hocus Pocus Less Focus podcast, host Suzanne Salazar and Denor Vasquez. They'll invite you to join them as they open up their broom closet and invite you to explore both the spiritual and metaphysical world. So sit back, relax with a well-brewed potion while our two witchy hosts bring you laughs as they focus on all this bunch of hocus pocus. You can find them on all major podcast platforms, including Spotify and iTunes. Check them out today. Hey guys, I just want to make a quick announcement. You can now get my book called Marcus the Vampire, available in audiobook format. You can find it on AudibleACX.com and on iTunes. Again, the name of the book is called Marcus the Vampire, The Dark World Chronicles. It's also available on Amazon.com. Check it out today if you can.
Hi, everyone. This is Deborah Driggs, and you are listening to the Mark the Shark Show.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Mark the Shark Show. And today we got a very special guest. His name is George Mikayan. How you doing, George?
Hey, Mark. How are you?
Good, good, good. Now, for everybody listening, George is an author, but he's a particular type of author. He likes to write about true crime. In fact, he's an expert in I guess it was an actual crime, DB Cooper. If you can give us a little detail on it, I'm not too familiar with the case. I'm assuming the guy got murdered or something.
Okay. Yeah, I can give your audience sort of a brief synopsis of the story.
Sure.
Okay. Well, all right. So November 24th, 1971, a man walks into airport in Portland, Oregon, and he buys a one-way ticket for a plane ride to Seattle. He's very, he's kind of a average looking guy. He's wearing he's a business suit, clean shaven, professional looking guy. He gets on the plane. Shortly after takeoff, he hands the flight attendant a note. And she just sticks it in her pocket quickly because she thinks it's another, you know, lonely businessman trying to hit on her. He calls her over and says, Miss, you better take a look at that note. I have a bomb. Now, of course, that gets her attention. He asks her to sit down next to him. He opens up his briefcase and shows her what appears to be a bomb. It looks like, you know, a bunch of sticks of dynamite with some wires and a, you know, large battery. Of course, she gets in touch with the pilots and alerts them to what's going on. At that point, he gives her his demands. His demands are, he wants $200,000 in cash, which doesn't sound like a lot, but in today's money, that's probably about $1.2 million. He wants 4 parachutes, and he wants a refueling truck ready in, you know, in Seattle when they land. So the pilots, they radio ahead to the air traffic control, and of course, they contact all local authorities and the FBI. The FBI gets involved at this point. The pilot of the plane tells the passengers, the flight was only about a third full, by the way, because this was the day before Thanksgiving. And he tells them there's some sort of minor mechanical difficulty. So they circle for about 2 hours while they get all this stuff together. They land in Seattle and they deliver this, they deliver everything to Dee Cooper. Now, one thing I should have mentioned earlier was, so when this man bought his ticket, he identified himself as Dan Cooper. Right. So okay. He identified himself as Dan Cooper. And then what happened was, you know, there was lots of media attention, of course. And there was one of the early suspects was a local guy whose name was D.B. Cooper. He was quickly ruled out, but there was a miscommunication with one of the reporters on the case. And that name is kind of just stuck. That's been that way ever since, even though there really is no relation to the actual guy who you know pulled off this hijacking. Okay, so then he says, you know, the plane takes off again, and the crew asks him, okay, well, where do you want to go? And he says he wants to go to Mexico City. Now, of course, he has no plans to go to Mexico City. He's going to jump out of this plane. So he then tells at this point, they've let all the passengers go. And the only ones left are one flight attendant. And of course, you know, the pilot, co-pilot, navigator. So there's only a skeleton crew on the plane. He tells her to go up front with the, in the cockpit. And at one point they feel sort of what they call it an oscillation, which just means there's like a change in cabin pressure on the plane. And when they land, this guy's gone. Immediately there's a search that's, search is organized with something like 1,000 different, police, FBI, National Guard troops. They're looking for this guy. Now, how they determine where to look, at one point they determined there's a flight path, and this was determined using, air traffic control, flight transcripts, flight recorder, et cetera. And so they scour the area. They don't find anything. I mean, nothing, not a shoe, not, of course, a body, no money, no parachute, nothing. And so the case kind of goes cold for a while. I mean, there's a big, there's a huge media interest at first, but they don't find anything. And again, this is, we're not only talking about thousands of law enforcement, but over the years, of course, there's all kinds of amateur detectives and, of course, treasure hunters who think they can find maybe at least some of this money, because it's all in cash. Now, so go to 9 years later, the case has kind of gone cold at this point. So there was like 1980. There's a family, and they're on the banks of the Columbia River, and they're having a picnic. Father tells his young son, he says, hey, why don't you dig a small little fire pit and we'll have a barbecue? So the boy does that. He digs a shallow pit and he finds 3 bundles of cash that are kind of rotting, And of course they turn this money in to the authorities. And what happened was when they originally gave this money to D.B. Cooper, they had recorded all the serial numbers on every single bill. So we're talking, you know, $10,000, $20 bills. And this money matched every bill that they could make out anyway, because again, this money was really in a degraded state. They determined that this money came from that hijacking. Now, what's curious is that out of all this money, again, this is $200,000, they found these three bundles. What's also interesting is that, so when they gave this money to D.B. Cooper originally, it's what was in called packets. Now, if you're going to a bank and you get a big stack of cash, they have like a paper band around it, you know. This money had rubber bands around it. And again, the rubber bands were degraded because they had been exposed to the elements for, we're not sure exactly how long. But so at some point, this money was, the original paper bands were removed and rubber bands were added. So that kind of leads some people to believe that, well, this guy, he must have made it to the ground, because how else was this money then, were these rubber bands added to these stacks of cash? Obviously, he didn't do it in midair on his way down. So that's part of the mystery. I mean, really, that's the only major clue that there is as far as the possibility that this guy made it to the ground. And of course, the biggest mysteries about this story are, first of all, who was this guy? Number one. And the second question is, did he make it? Because you could make a case for either way, that he didn't make it or that he did make it. And I can get into that if you want me to.
Like what made them think that he didn't make it?
Well, they don't think the FBI, I should mention. So the FBI, they had a case on this for 45 years. And 2016, they essentially gave up because there really wasn't any kind of new information. And so in 2016, they just kind of threw up their hands and said, well, okay, until any new information presents itself, we're kind of done. We have to, direct our resources in other directions. So one reason why people think he may not have made it was that there hasn't been any examples of this money, other than that money found on this beach called Tina Bar, showing up in circulation, not anywhere, not a casino, in any banks or anywhere. And that's really interesting. On the other hand, there hasn't been one bit of evidence found. And now we're going, this November 24th, it'll be the 50th anniversary of this event. And nothing has been found in 50 years. And believe me, people have tried. They've scoured this area from top to bottom. Nothing has been found in all this time. And at the same time, a more practical reason is there were never any missing, missing persons reported around that time that matched this guy's description. And I mean, no man is an island. Everyone has someone in their life, I mean, I hope, that cares about them, either friends, family, colleagues, or whatever. So there was never any missing persons filed that matched this guy's description. So there's, one reason why he made it, and another reason why maybe he didn't make it. It's really interesting. And I can get into some of the suspects if you like.
Yeah. I mean, how'd you find out about this case? Like, do you write books on this, or is this like your, passion, but like a hobby of yours, or?
It's one of those things, that I've known about since I was a kid. And again, this story is going to be 50 years old. So, I mean, it's been around for quite a while, and I've always had an interest in it because it's unsolved. It's kind of it's an unsolved mystery. It's a true crime. It's a missing person. It's a whodunit. It's all these different things wrapped up into one story. And it's the kind of story, that just couldn't happen today, because back then we're talking 1971, there was really no, airport security really didn't exist. I mean, you could pretty much get on a plane with anything. I mean, think about this guy walked on a plane with a briefcase. They didn't search his briefcase. He didn't have to show any kind of identification as to who he really was. He just said, "I'm Dan Cooper, and here's $20 and I want a ticket to get on your plane. And they let him on the plane. There was no metal detectors. So there really wasn't any kind of security at all. There were no security cameras anywhere. There certainly weren't any at the airport. Obviously not on a plane. It's not like now where everyone has a camera on them 24/7.
And then they have like a fingerprints from this guy or?
Well, okay. So one of the things I should mention is he was very careful in how he handled this because he got on the plane and when he wrote the note, he passed a few notes to the flight attendants, but he was careful to collect those notes back. So it's not to, yeah. I mean, I'm trying to get this all in as quickly as I can. Now, the only things he left behind were, they think he left his tie behind. It was a clip-on tie, believe it or not. And 6 cigarette butts. Because this was the early 70s and a lot of people smoked and you were allowed to smoke on planes back then, believe it or not. They weren't able to, this is the early days before DNA technology was in the advanced stage that it is now, but they really weren't able to extract anything kind of close to DNA or fingerprints. And I should also mention, so the only thing left behind was the tie. And the cigarette butts. Now he was careful to take the briefcase with the bomb, whether or not the bomb was real or fake, I guess we'll never know. And of course he took all the money, he took the notes. So he left very little evidence behind. And of course he gave a fake name. And halfway through the flight, if any of your audience is familiar with this case, they'll probably have seen the famous police sketches where one of them, he's wearing sunglasses. Yeah, so halfway through the flight, he put on sunglasses, and I guess in a way to describe himself, to change his appearance. And why he did it halfway through the flight, I don't know. But he was very careful. And I should also mention two other things. When the plane took off again from Seattle after the passengers had been let go, and by the way, the passengers who were on the plane before that, they had no idea they had been involved in hijacking, because this guy was so calm, cool, and collected and kept things so quiet that these passengers had no idea that they had been involved in this hijacking, because he wasn't one of these guys. You always picture the stereotypical hijackers as running to the front of the plane and waving a pistol around and saying, take me to Cuba or something like that. No, he kept things very quiet and professional, and he was described as calm, cool, collected, and even the flight attendants who dealt with him as being polite, well-spoken, intelligent. So he did this in a really professional way. I mean, you can imagine how stressful this situation would be for someone, because you're not only you're hijacking a plane, but then you're planning to jump out of this plane at 10,000 feet. So it's a stressful situation to say the least. And yet this guy, he was very, very cool. Now a lot of people, that gets to the whole question of who was this guy and some of the suspects, major suspects that have been discussed over the years. A lot of people think he may have been some sort of either a CIA agent or some sort of someone with either a military or intelligence services background, because again, he pulled this off so professionally, and he also knew a lot about this particular plane that he hijacked. Now, this was a 727, Boeing 727. This plane was very unusual in that it had something called aft stairs. And what that is, they're kind of like stairs that come up from the bottom of the plane, sort of from like the belly of the plane. And these were designed for smaller airports that didn't maybe have a gate or a terminal. So it allowed passengers to deplane right onto the tarmac. And it was used for some short haul flights and that sort of thing. He knew that these stairs could be used as sort of a launching point from the plane. And we're talking 1971. Back then, it's not like today where if you wanna know about something, you jump on Google and in 5 minutes, you're an expert. Back then, this kind of information was known by very, very few people. In fact, the pilots of the plane didn't even know that this was possible, that someone could open these stairs in mid-flight and jump out of them successfully like this guy did. So that leads a lot of people to believe that he, at the very least, had some sort of paratrooper military training, or again, possibly could have been involved in the CIA, because the CIA used this particular plane, a 727, in their Air America efforts. I don't know how much you or your audience are familiar with that, but very briefly, it was basically a passenger and cargo airline owned and operated by the CIA. And it had, you know, a huge fleet of planes of all different sizes and configurations. And the 727 was one of those. And that plane was used in Vietnam to drop not only, you know, soldiers, but also, you know, supplies and so forth. It was used for military missions and also for humanitarian missions. So there's, you know, that's why a lot of people believe that this guy may have been ex-CIA, and why he did this, of course, we'll never know. But actually, one of the flight attendants asked him at one point and said, "Do you have a grudge against our airline?" And he told her, he said, "I don't have a grudge against your airline. I just have a grudge." Now, what that grudge is, of course, I would love to know, but that, you know, only D.B. Cooper knows or knew it, you know, but I would certainly love to know what his grudge was. So anyway, so now here we are, it's 50 years later, and this mystery is still out there. There are websites and books and these, you know, citizen sleuths who are out there who are just obsessed with this case 50 years on, because you know, there really are that many of these cases that have been out there for so long and with so little evidence as to, you know, who this person was, why they did it, and what happened to them. So that's why I got very interested in this story. And I thought that the adult coloring book was kind of an interesting format for this case, because it lends itself to an exciting visual event. I mean, you know, we have a guy dressed up in a business suit, sort of like the guys from Men in Black, and he's jumping out of a plane at 10,000 feet into a November rainy, cold night in the Northwest of the United States, landing in, of course, no one knows exactly where, but many people believe he got away with it. And some people think it's really interesting, and they see him sort of as an anti-hero in that he got something over on, you know, the airlines and the banks and so forth. And they have seen him as some sort of anti-hero.
Yeah. And then you wrote a book on this too. Actually, it's on Amazon, but it seems pretty interesting in that it's a coloring book.
Right.
And well, why'd you choose that for, man? That's kind of interesting.
Well, I'll tell you why, because, you know, there are a lot of books out there on this subject already. I thought this was a different take on it. And I saw this as, you know, a lot of people might be interested in this case, but maybe they're not interested in reading, you know, a 300 page book on this. I saw this as a way, sort of an introductory way of, you know, introducing this case to someone who might be curious about this case. And again, it's a very accessible for most people. And it was sort of an attempt to bring a whole new audience to this case, because again, this, we're talking 50 years ago, most people, you know, a lot of people weren't even alive when this first happened, and have very little knowledge of it. I don't know if any of your listeners are fans of the show Loki, which is on Disney Plus.
Yeah, I watch it actually.
Okay, so you probably saw early on they had like a little commercial, you know, a little promo, like a 3-minute promo featuring imagining Loki as D.D. Cooper. I mean, you can look it up on YouTube if you wanted to. So it just goes to show you that, again, even 50 years later, this is still, you know, part of the you know, the zeitgeist of pop culture. And just imagining Loki as D.D. Cooper, I think it illustrates the staying power and interest in this case. Now, you should also mention, I thought that I thought it was interesting because, again, the adult coloring, of course, a lot of people don't kind of, you know, think of adult coloring as, or coloring in general just for children, but there's been a like explosion of popularity in these books over the last 10 years. And as a matter of fact, just since COVID, so we're talking, you know, almost 2 years ago now, there's been an even bigger increase in the sales of these kinds of books because of their, you know, therapeutic value in that they've been proven to reduce stress and anxiety. They can improve your motor skills and vision. They improve sleep and focus, and they actually work both sides of your brain in that they want, you know, there's the logical side that wants to stay inside the lines. And then there's a creative side that wants to, you know, use different colors and make these images kind of come to life. And of course they're used extensively in art and therapy. So I thought this was a kind of an interesting way of bringing all these things together and sort of had, so the idea is this, you know, this book has, you know, multiple benefits in that you're kind of learning something, you're entertained, you're interacting with the story, and that you're literally interacting, you're filling in the blanks, you're adding your own color. And at the same time, there's the, you know, there's the therapeutic value of adult coloring on its own.
Hmm. Well, that's very interesting, George. That was a very interesting story. Unfortunately, we're a little bit out of time here, but it was great having you on the show.
Thank you, Mark.
It's always, I always find that fascinating. True crime stories. I've always been an avid fan of that. I like that Loki representation that you brought into it too. So that was kind of interesting. All right, everybody. We'll be back after a short break.
Hi, this is Coraline Jewell. You're listening to the Mark the Shark podcast show.
Hey guys, just want to let everybody know that if you're looking for a good suspense thriller action novel, check out the book written by me, Mark the Shark, called The Cabal, The Saga Begins. If you go to my website now, www.retortofamilybooks, you can get an autographed signed copy for only $8 plus shipping. Again, go to www.retortofamilybooks.com. Hi everyone. Well, unfortunately, all good things must come to an end, and that's all we have for this particular podcast episode. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you keep following my podcast here, the Mark the Shark Show, and keep listening and look out for future podcast episodes.